I'd give anything not to tilt.
Then why haven't you?
I have become a good poker player.
Are you saying you used to be a fish?
Only in the worst way.
Well, how did you know when you weren't a fish anymore? Did you just wake up one morning with no gills?
Just play. Why do you keep asking me these stupid questions?
Are you sure they're stupid?
I'm never sure of anything with you. Do you think you can make me tiltless?
Do you think you can change your mind?
Welcome to the final episode of the Eightfold Path to Poker Enlightenment, where it all ends. The path. The road. Where we find out how to become tiltless. I'm Wayne Lively, and as you all know, our guide on this journey, our Buddha buddy, is Tommy Angelo.
Well, that's quite an introduction there, Wayne. Too bad it's all wrong.
I'm shocked.
Well, the thing you got wrong is that tiltlessness has no endpoint. It's a never-ending quest to play our A game more often. And we do that by way of reducing our suffering.
And God knows, and everyone else, after 7 episodes with me, you've suffered a lot.
Well, actually, Wayne, I do like to think of you as a provider.
Huh?
Yeah, because what you do is you provide me with so many opportunities to practice smoothing out my tilt waves.
It's my pleasure to serve you, sir. Have you ever tilted?
Oh, God, yes. I still do. But not nearly as bad as I used to.
Okay. What was your worst tilt like? Did you ever punch anybody out?
I've never punched anybody out. I've said some nasty things. I had ways of saying things that were very mean.
Did you ever get punched out?
I've never been punched out. Nope.
Well, so you got that going for you.
Yeah, I haven't really experienced violent tilt on either end. I've blown my bankroll multiple times doing completely ridiculous things.
Just total busto, huh?
Well, not my whole bankroll. I just blow my pocket bankroll, whatever I could get my hands on. I'll tell you how bad it was. When I moved to California, I intentionally moved right next door to Chuck Joe's because the highest game they had was, they had 15-30 and 20-40 limit every day. And down at Bay 101, half an hour away, they had 8160. They had 40-80 and 8160. Well, I intentionally didn't live down there because I knew that I would just destroy myself in those games. I couldn't contain myself to just play 20-40 because when I was tilted, I would go to the higher game, bankroll tilt. So what I would do is I would play for like, I did this probably 4 or 5 times, where I'd play for 15 or 20 hours totally stuck at 20-40 at Artichoke Joe's, and the game would break, and I still had money. So I had no choice. I would drive all the way down to Bay 101 after playing a terribly long, brutal session, because that was the only way I could dump the rest of my bankroll. I'd go down there and play 8160.
Jeez.
That's me on tilt.
Did you tilt online?
Online, I tilted so bad. I could play A-plus poker for days, weeks, months, and my graph looked like just the steadiest incline you could imagine. And then just completely go nuts. But when I tilted like a Bay 101, at least I looked like I was playing decent. It's possible to kind of know you're going to lose but not look terrible. Online, I would tilt where I was literally just raising and re-raising every hand, just with anything, just to completely, as bad as it is physically possible to tilt.
Full-on monkey.
Absolutely full-on insanity. Set fire to my money. Thank you.
made you tilt?
Boy, a lot of things. I mean, all the classic stuff, you know, you could say losing money and just feeling like crap.
What were you thinking? I mean, what were you thinking at the time? Put you on tilt.
It's such a funny thing to look back on, because I felt like at the time I was doing a lot of self-examination in between tiltings, you know, during my between sessions, like, what the hell's wrong with me? I have to quit doing that. And back then, if you would ask me these questions, I would have given all these reasons, like, you know, that guy, you know, set me off, or I wasn't getting a good enough sleep, or playing bad, feeling bad about how bad I played. There's just so many classic reasons you could come up with.
Just unhappy?
Just general unhappiness, yeah. Just general unhappiness. But, you know, it's hard to say what comes first. Is the tilting and the losing money causing unhappiness, or was I just fundamentally unhappy in a way I didn't understand, and that was like fueling tilt? But
one thing you said I want to pick up on is that it was external things that were causing you to tilt.
It seemed that way. You know, it's hard for me to answer these questions now, because as we're going to get into later on, now I really have a much, much deeper understanding of the cause of tilt. And all of the external things that I would have pointed to as the causes aren't. They just aren't. That's all part of the delusion, is that we think that because we lost something, that is the actual cause of the tilt. But it's really the attachment to the thing we lost. It isn't the loss in itself. It's just this.
So it's not loss that causes tilt?
Well, not really. It seems like it. But, for example, you could be tilting even when you haven't lost. You could be winning and tilting, right?
Sure, I guess.
So there has to be some other causes of tilt. Just, it isn't loss. So let's take a look at an example from regular life, since we happen to have such a dandy to talk about, which was what happened in our last recording session.
Oh, no. This is going to be so embarrassing.
Well, it's going to be painful. You're going to be reliving the pain. So tell them what happened, Wayne.
We spent hours working on, you know, the show. You know, we were
recording away. Yeah.
Absolutely. And we came back. And
the next day.
Yeah, several hours of work was gone. Poof. I mean, it was gone.
Flatline.
it was just gone. And my reaction was what most normal human beings' reaction was. I tilted. I went nuts. I was like, I can't believe this. This was irreplaceable stuff. This was stuff that really was really, really good.
We were clicking.
And it was gone. And your reaction was?
My reaction was non-resistance to the moment. Was yesterday there was data in my life that was a recording we had made, and today there wasn't. And at that moment, there wasn't a damn thing I could do about it, and that was my current reality.
And it was even worse for me, because you didn't feed into mine. I was punching into, you know, the marshmallow man.
Yeah.
I mean, you just did not react.
Well, that's actually
to
the
mine.
Good thing. You know, if I had been as tilted as you, we would have been fueling the tilt.
Yeah.
Compounding the tilt, but by me being just completely in the moment and accepting of that current reality and not attached to the data, therefore this supposed loss, which I'm putting in quotes in my finger,
because
wasn't a loss at all.
Then
there
it came
was
back.
No loss,
we found
it was simply what there is.
Right.
Right.
And then we found it.
Well, we didn't actually find it. We called our man Rob, a deuce is cracked, and being the wizard that he is, he told me some magical way I could restore what I thought was lost data. So all of a sudden we were back in action. We had what we had lost.
And I was happy.
You were extremely happy. You were just as happy as you were set.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, okay. I confess.
Right? And so, and what was I doing?
When the exact same thing.
I was just as non-happy as I had been non-set.
You wouldn't even have noticed the difference one way or the other.
Right. And I'm saying this, it sounds almost like I'm bragging, but it's not. I'm just as in awe of that as you are, because I used to be just as much of a tilt monster as anybody else on earth. When it came to losing data, I used to record all the time back in the 80s in my house, and I've had entire batches of magnetic tape ruined by magnets and stuff like that, and I would suffer over it for days, months, years, literally years. Oh, that song's gone forever. And now that I can observe myself not falling into that spiraling trap of being so attached that there's all these losses. And then when there's a gain, it's like spikes, up, down, all around. That's what's gone through the practice.
It's maddening. You want to know what the grand delusion is?
Enlighten me.
Comb-overs.
It's a good one.
I'm bald. I'm not going to convince anybody that parting my hair behind my ear and pulling it over the top of my head is, I'm not bald. I'm right. Bald. It only deludes the person who does it. Mm-hmm. A girl I once knew, her happiness was in stuff. If she could only get this thing or that thing, whatever caught her eye at the moment, it would make her happy. She was never happy because she could never get enough stuff.
Yeah.
That's the grand delusion. The grand delusion is that external things are making us unhappy. And if we just fix that...
Right. And then external things can make us happy.
Right.
Same thing.
Exactly. Exactly.
You know, for example, you desire a new car.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say that you wanted a new car and you went out and got the new car. Mm-hmm. Are you then permanently happy the rest of your life? No. You're going to want the next thing. This is human nature. And we're calling it the grand delusion, the idea that if only I had the next thing, I would be happy. Or it's because I lost that thing that I'm unhappy. They're
it's
identical.
All about attachment.
Yeah.
I lived in Florida in 2004. Hurricane Charley came along and took the house and virtually everything in it. The only thing that I missed were the irreplaceable, you know, childhood memories, stuff that I wasn't able to pass along to my kids. Mm-hmm. You know, that now only exist in my mind.
That's why some people that have nothing, you know, we look at some people like, how can that guy be happy? He has nothing. He's happy because he has nothing. You know, it's because of the non-attachment to stuff is how some people can be completely poor and be way, way happier than rich people. I mean, these ideas have been kicked around so many times. You know, one of the things I ask my clients is like, especially some of the big money guys, they got big bankrolls. And they come to me and they're like, I have everything now that I wanted. Everything 3 years ago that I thought I wanted that would make me happy, I have. I have the entire poker world respecting me. I have all the money in the world. I have my health. I'm good looking. I've got a hot girlfriend. And I'm still discontent. And
it's a grand illusion.
But we can look at those types of people that have had that path as proof that there's no amount of accumulation that is going to give us peace of mind. It simply can't happen that way. And the delusion is that we go through our whole lives, despite this evidence, still believing that if only I had that one more thing, I would be happy.
It's about attachment.
It's totally about attachment and desire.
And
one
loss.
Of the things I ask these
and
guys...
And that's what puts us on tilt, is losing it, or the fear of loss.
Oh, the fear of loss. Yeah, the attachment causes all fear. All fear is a result of attachment, every single speck of it. One of the things I ask guys to kind of wake them up to this is like, okay, so you're, let's say you got a guy who's, you know, just a typical good professional player, his bankroll somewhere between, say, $50,000 and $200,000. And he's like, but, you know, last year I was up to $300,000. I really want to get back to that mark. And I just say, what if you had $10 billion? What if a guy just gave you $10 billion? Do you think that you would be permanently at peace? Do you think you would never, ever again suffer from anger or jealousy or rage? Do you think all these things would just be gone because of a number in your bank account? Of course not.
Do you think that you're never going to drive again? You're never going to be in
line at
Walmart?
Yeah, never go on tilt in traffic or be late or be frustrated with your parents or someone else? Of course not.
And when it comes to the grand delusion, the number of ways we can delude ourselves is incredible. I want to be happy.
Are you saying you're unhappy now?
Yes.
What, with poker, life, or just in general?
Yes.
Okay, well, you hit right on the premise of this whole series.
I've come to the right place.
Yeah. What we're really talking about here isn't how to become a great poker player, or how to have lots of money, or how to be loved, or be a good person. The central issue of this episode and this series is how to be happy, that we want to be happy. That's the premise, that we want to be happier than we are now, and we want to be more deeply happy more often. And everything related to tilt and tiltlessness is like this quest to be happier by way of undoing our suffering. And we're going to talk more about suffering later, but for right now we can just equate tilt with suffering. That tilt is a cause of suffering, and tilt is an effect of suffering, and to whatever extent we can undo tilt, whether we talk about emotional tilt or just all the other, you know, lesser types of tilt we've talked about, every one of those we want to look at as being on the course toward happiness. That's the premise of everything we're doing here.
Tilt causes unhappiness, and unhappiness causes tilt.
It does. It goes right around the circle, just like that. Tilt is a cause and an effect. In fact, one of the grand teachings is that everything is a cause and effect. Rain is caused by some things, and rain has an effect after it happens. Every single thing in the universe is equally a cause and an effect, including tilt.
Last night I was playing No Limit, and I doubled up early.
Nice.
It felt good. And then I went on a heater, and I doubled again, and I got up three buy-ins really, really quickly. And then hit a cold spell and lost a buy-in, and then was, you know, down another buy-in. So I'd still doubled up.
Right. So now you're up one buy-in?
Yeah, I doubled up.
Right.
But I felt really bad.
Right.
Because I was up three buy-ins.
Yeah.
And now I'm back to, you know, just doubling up. Now, if, you know, before the game had started, if you had said, you know, you'll double your money tonight, I'd have been very happy.
Yeah. And when you did double the first time, you felt great.
I was happy.
Right. And then you hit the same spot later, but because you were on a downswing instead of an upswing, you felt bad.
Yes.
Even though your bankroll at that moment was exactly the same.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So what happened?
Well, that's a great example of how attached we get to just recent history. You know, it's like, if you think about it in theory, what the heck difference does it make how you got to that point? At any point, no matter what your bankroll is, it is what it is at that moment. And this is what it means to be in the moment and accepting reality as it is. If only we could just live with our bankroll every single second, no matter what it was, the amount of agony we would let go of is huge. Because we wouldn't be wishing it was more. We wouldn't be thinking, oh, man, it used to be more, or wishing it was more. And that is such a great example to show how silly we are. You know, another one that's remarkably similar to that from regular life is weight loss and weight gain and how we feel about our bodies. Let's say you got a guy who weighs 200 pounds and he wishes he weighs 170 pounds.
I wish.
So that's causing him suffering right there, the fact that his reality is that he weighs 200 pounds, and every single moment that the thought happens to come to his mind that he wishes he weighed less, that's causing him suffering. That's what we mean by suffering. So let's say he loses 10 pounds, and now he weighs 190. He's like, great, I'm stoked. And anytime we want to lose weight, we lose weight. We feel great about the discipline, and we're lighter. It's beautiful. So then he goes on, he loses another 20. He gets all the way down to 170. He's absolutely ecstatic, feels great, and he's so attached to that, though. This happiness comes from attachment, the same thing that causes suffering. You know, it's going to change. This is one of the grand lessons, is impermanence. He's not going to weigh 170 for the next 70 years. And as soon as he gains weight, it's going to cause more unhappiness because he's attached to 170. But now look what happens. This is like your example. Later on, he's back up to 190. He's gained 20 pounds from his optimum weight. Now he's miserable, absolutely bombed. But look, he still weighs the same 190 he did when he was coming down. So if you go from 200 to 190, you feel great. You go from 170 to 190, you feel like shit. Just like with the buy-ins, right? All the same stuff.
You're talking to a junior lineman here.
A junior lineman?
Yes. I can certainly relate to someone who feels way over their size. So, yeah, I can understand it very well because the weight is, you know, one of those things that all of us seem to have a problem with.
Yeah.
Except for your skinny ass.
Well, no, I've had plenty of times I was, you know, 20, 30 pounds overweight and felt miserable about it. I mean, really bad. And it's like, now I've gotten to the point, it's like, you know, I look at my body and that day, at that second, it's how it is. It's just like my bankroll. I mean, I think this correlation to body and bankroll is pretty strong.
I wish my bankroll had weighed as much as I do. Throughout the Eightfold Path to Poker Enlightenment, we have talked about suffering, but we've never really defined what suffering is.
You're right, we haven't, and it's one of those words that it carries extra connotation in Buddhistic teaching, you know, compared to the way we normally use it.
If I slam my hand in the car door, that's pain.
That's pain. That's physical pain. That's nerve impulses going to your brain. It's a physical thing.
But it's not suffering.
It's not suffering. The stuff that gets stirred up in your head about how could I be such an idiot, or man, this is going to hurt for a week, that's suffering. That's the difference between pain and suffering by these definitions. So, you know, suffering is it's like an affliction. That's one of the words they call it. It's an affliction. It's just a thing that arises in our mind.
At the beginning of the episode, I said in the Grand Delusions that the ways we delude ourselves are countless.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing with suffering.
Yeah, in fact, there are sanctioned varieties of suffering in the Buddhist teaching.
Like worry.
Regret.
Fear.
Anger.
Stress.
Dissatisfaction.
Annoyance.
Conflict.
Panic.
Unease.
Nervousness.
Aggravation.
I'm too busy.
I'm too fat.
I'm inadequate. Worry.
Is suffering.
Regret.
Is suffering.
Fear.
Is suffering.
Anger.
Is suffering.
Stress.
Is suffering. Ignorance. In regular English, the way we use it, it means lack of knowledge, not knowing. And in the Buddhist meaning, it's a word that gets used a fair amount along with delusion. It sounds a little insulting, but neither word is really intended to be that way. I saw one little thing about the word ignorance I thought was really pretty cool. If you look at the root word, it's ignore. And ignore doesn't mean not knowing. It just means ignoring, you know, not paying attention to it or not reacting to it. So really the word ignorance, you could think of it as ignorance. So it's just, you know, the noun version of the verb ignore. It means not paying attention. It means not noticing what's going on around you. So it's really a whole different meaning, and when you look at it like that, just based on the actual English root word. So I think that's pretty cool. And then another word is emptiness.
Welcome back, my friends, to the show that never ends. Ladies and gentlemen.
Come inside, come inside.
Emerson, Lake, and Palmer. We're going to talk about the lake.
The lake, yes. We're going to talk about the lake as a metaphor
and a few other metaphors. Think of your mind as the water in a lake. On the surface of the lake, it's sometimes smooth, and sometimes there's wind, and it creates waves, and it's very choppy. When we're agitated or upset, you can think of that as being your mind, being the surface of your mind, the very top, with these waves all over the place. Or you could think of a big event coming and falling like a big rock into the lake and creating waves, making a big splash. And this metaphor is really great because over time, the waves will smooth out. You know, with breathing and mindful practice, you can smooth out the waves faster or even right away. But the really cool thing about this metaphor is that right under the surface of the lake, you only have to go down a few feet, and it's always smooth. It's always calm. And that's a great way to think of your mind, as underneath the surface of all the agitation, all the waves, is a calmness. And all you have to do is still yourself and calm yourself, and you can connect with that part of you. Very nice, Wayne. You're really getting the hang of this. Another really helpful metaphor that I learned from Jon Kabat-Zinn, who's one of my main teachers, is the idea of what he says is if you have an orchestra, you got these great musicians and they're playing this great music, and it doesn't matter how talented they are or how great the music is, they have to tune up. If they don't tune up right before they play, they're going to suck.
Yeah, it sounds like traffic noise.
Yeah.
It really does.
Actually, I love the sound of an orchestra tuning up.
Really?
Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, it sounds like traffic noise to me.
That is one of my favorite sounds of all sounds. And so what he says is when you calm yourself using the breathing or some sort of mindfulness at any point, it doesn't matter whether you're talking about, he's talking mainly about a morning meditation practice where you really put some time into it. He says what you do is you just tune yourself like an instrument for the day, and now you're in tune. And if you do it in the morning, you're just going to be more in tune that entire day. And the same concept can go right into your poker game where, let's say you're playing online and you take a break and you decide to even just spend just a few breaths, just sitting very still to calm yourself and breathe. You can just think of that as tuning up, literally tuning your instrument. And in this case, you think of yourself as being the instrument. And then after you've tuned, you are also the musician. You play the instrument.
Let's go surfing now. Everybody's learning how. Let's talk about surfing the breath.
Surfing the breath, another really simple, easy metaphor. You know, the idea is to just follow the ins and outs of your breath. And in episode 3, we went into quite a bit of detail about it. There's the breathing in, I'm aware I'm breathing in, breathing out, I'm aware I'm breathing out. But eventually you can just, not even eventually, but in addition to that, you can just think in and out, just observing the in and out. And another way to do that is to think of it as surfing, like you're just riding up, down, up, down, up, down. So the idea, just the word surfing the breath is another helpful metaphor.
And finally, one of your Tommyisms that I thought the first time I heard it was absolutely brilliant. Tilted poker is like crooked teeth. It's not your fault and can be fixed.
Yeah. It's true. There's two parts to this. One is that if you have crooked teeth, it's pretty obvious this is a case of nature, not nurture. And you know, there's nothing you had to do with it, just like eye color, mm-hmm. right? And thinking of your tilt and your tilt at poker in that way, I believe it's true. You know, it isn't your fault because what it comes from is the entire sum of human suffering that has accumulated over literally tens, hundreds, thousands of years, however far back, you know, they say modern, you know, anatomically modern humans started roughly 200,000 years ago, but you can go back further than that if you like, whatever. It's an accumulation of the non-mindfulness, or whatever you want to call it, that is the cause of tilt. And that's what I mean by it's not your fault. You just have it. We all have it. And the idea that it can be fixed in the same way that crooked teeth can be fixed is that over time, with many, many small incremental changes, it can be fixed, just like crooked teeth.
Okay. Another reason why that it hit me so well is that just like crooked teeth, it can be fixed. It's going to take some time. Mm-hmm. It's going to require some discomfort. But at the end of it, you'll smile a lot more.
Wow, that's a great add-on, Wayne. I think I'm going to have to go write an addendum to that Tommyism.
You're welcome to it. Life is a pretty big topic.
Yep.
Hard to get your arms around the whole thing. Since we're here for the poker, why don't we just talk about the ways that we suffer and tilt at poker and how we get rid of it.
All right. So what do you think, like, the top two causes of tilt at poker? I think it's, like, you know, based on my own experience and the feedback I get, it's bad luck. You know, when we get really unlucky, it's like, oh, so unfair, hand after hand. And playing bad.
Well, you know, right? I never tell a bad beat story.
Really? When is that going to start?
Okay. Well, and I never play bad.
Oh, of course not.
So
you're tiltless.
I guess.
Yeah, nothing to worry about.
I think we need to go on.
Yeah, good idea. When it comes to handling bad beats, this is why we practice non-resistance. This is why we practice seeing reality in the moment and looking it right in the face and training ourselves to come to terms with the fact that we just lost money. And the reason we lost money is because the guy hit a card he needed, and there were only four cards in the deck that he would win with, and one of them came up, and that is what happened. It sounds so simple and so obvious to just not add on to that reality and just live with it and live in it. And it's so hard to do, but there's no other thing I can offer as a remedy for the suffering that's caused by bad beats other than moving your awareness out a level from your absorption with the injustice and the unfairness and all the other thoughts. And it's all about awareness. It's about being aware of the actual mental activity in your mind and calling it what it is and saying, the whole reality, the card came, I lost the pot, this is causing my mind to stir up like the surface of the lake and creating waves. And only by continuing to go outside of that, like layers of an onion, and just going outside another layer, and seeing the actual thought formations arise in your mind, this is the way to end the suffering.
And then playing bad.
Playing bad is such a huge cause of tilt and suffering for poker players. And it doesn't matter why we played bad. It could be we played bad because we were already on tilt. It could be because we just made a bad play. It's another case of regret, of living in the past. You know, we just beat ourselves up, and especially if it's a big pot, you know, it might be a significant part of our bankroll, where our bankroll is a significant part of our living expenses, and it's just like just this gigantic heap of suffering that we go through, and then we keep coming back to, oh, it's my fault. If only I hadn't made that bad play. So the way to ease this suffering is in many ways similar to before, which is you just keep peeling back layers of the onion and observing what is. Okay, I did in fact play bad. And then just accepting that reality. Now, another whole other side to this thing, you could say, well, if I didn't play bad, that would be the way to get rid of that problem. And the way to do that is to focus on doing your best. Okay, if you focus on doing your best and really examine what that means, and that if you believe that doing your best means sitting up straight and doing breathing, and you didn't do that, then you didn't do your best. If you believe that doing your best involves how well you sleep and how well you eat and how well you game select and how well you seat select and how well you sight select and do all these zillions of options, if every one of those is part of what you call doing your best at poker, not just your betting strategy, then the way to ease the suffering of beating yourself up over playing bad is to focus on doing your best. And this is why. If you know you've done your best, it won't matter if you play bad, because you'll know you've done your best. It's like, let's say you go out golfing and you really play your best round, but it turns out that you hit a few flubby shots along the way, but you were focused. You really gave it your all. It's possible to play bad, but still having done your best. And so the real thing here is focus on doing your best, and then you don't have regrets. That's the whole point. If you know you've done your best, there's literally nothing to regret.
A friend of mine, I told you this story, I used to play tournament tennis, and he came off the court, and I said, how'd you do? He said, I came in second. He didn't lose.
That's a good attitude. Right.
He didn't
lose.
Right,
he came in second.
He just got beat.
Uh-huh.
That's
a great case of
perception. The guy was better than him, and you know, he didn't lose. He played as well as he could and came in second.
Right.
I've always thought that that was a good attitude.
It is. That's a great attitude. It just goes to show you the perception. You know, well, perception is reality, and we have the ability to alter our perceptions, but really only by first observing the act of being perceivers and really observing the mind and examining what's going on up there.
You're going at it from one direction. I'm going at it from the other direction, okay? You're saying, you know, when you blame other people, it's causing suffering in your brain. And it's, you know, if the other people weren't to blame, it wouldn't cause suffering in my brain. If I wasn't at fault, it wouldn't cause suffering in my brain. Yes, it does. No, it does. How can you say that? Yeah, and this is...
Well, I'm just saying that...
I'm
just saying that the act of blaming is the suffering. It doesn't matter who did what.
But it's not my fault.
The thing that you're blaming them for.
Right.
But the act of playing the blame game is your fault.
No, it's not. It's their fault.
It's their fault that you can't control your mind, that you obsess over blaming people for stuff.
But
it's your fault.
But if it's, you know, if they hadn't done it.
Let's do the script.
Is it running?
Yeah.
Let it run.
Wayne, you shouldn't play the blame game.
Try again.
Don't play the blame game.
But it wasn't my fault.
What wasn't your fault?
What happened?
Well, but so what? You're playing the blame game. You're blaming.
But it's not my fault. It could have been the dealer's fault. It could have been traffic's fault, the casino, my parents, my school. It could have been God's fault.
Right, so what good does it do you to blame them except it just causes suffering? Blame is a form of suffering.
So it's now huge. I'm blaming myself for blaming them?
If you want to blame yourself for something, yes. That's what you should blame yourself. You should blame yourself for blaming them. Yeah.
This is nuts. I didn't do this.
Well, but you're doing it. You're doing it. Anytime you blame somebody for something else, you're stirring up the surface of your lake. For nothing. It's just mental noise. It's just more crap.
But then how do you get rid of it? I mean, yeah, it's
you don't
there.
Blame. You don't blame people for anything, ever. Doesn't matter what they do. You just don't blame.
You just stop blaming. I don't buy this.
That's what you do. You don't play the blame game. And then you start with yourself. You start with not blaming yourself.
Well, if I did it, you talk about being stirred up.
Yeah.
I can handle other people's screw-ups. A lot better than I can my own.
Well, that's okay, though. It's better to do that. One of the teachings is, this is literally word for word, roll all blames into one. In other words, no matter what happens, you're better off just saying it's my fault. So if somebody gets in an argument with you or somebody attacks you, you just say, it's my fault. You don't blame others.
Well, I do that. You know why I do that? It's the only thing I have control over. I can't. If I blame you for something, I have no control over that.
You have control over the act of blaming, though.
But if I blame myself for something that I did that caused you to do something that you did, I have control over that. So I don't do that again. So that won't cause you to do something, and you know it escalates
but you're
and
still,
stirs it all up.
It doesn't matter what the thing is. It doesn't matter if somebody plows into your car because he ran a red light because he was drunk. You don't play the blame game. You just don't blame people. I know it sounds crazy, and you know what?
All right, let me ask you one more thing.
Okay.
Okay, what if someone is blaming me, and it's their fault. How do I
handle
that?
Oh, that's the biggest one. You just, here's what you do. You just suck it in. You suck it in, and you don't spit it back out.
Screw you, doesn't work, huh?
In fact, this is one of the greatest ones, is when you are unjustly accused of something. It doesn't matter. It could be the most trivial thing. It could be huge. And you absolutely know that you weren't wrong, and you are being blamed. This is the greatest test. Can you not react to that? Can you not continue the blame game and send back out the stuff? You just absorb it in, and you don't send it out. And it's the greatest test. I'm telling you, if you can ever do this, and I've done it enough times to know how unbelievably awesome it is, where I'm blamed for something. And I, you know, there's this one great story they tell about a monk who is accused of getting a woman pregnant, of getting this young woman pregnant. And they accuse him. He's like, okay. He never objected to it. He never even said anything like, I didn't do it. And then like years later, the girl confessed. She said that he had done it. And years later, she confessed and said he didn't do it. And they come back to him and they said, hey, you've been absolved. You know, we know that you didn't do it. He's like, okay. No blame. No, it doesn't matter how right you are. The more correct you are and the more mistreated you are by somebody blaming you for something you didn't do, the more strength you will gain and the higher level of awareness and enlightenment you will have by not saying, no, you're wrong, you're wrong, you're wrong. I was unjustly accused. You just suck it in. This is the deepest level of not playing the blame game, and it's big time. Big time stuff. You know, let's talk a little bit about the blame game in our little episode we have with losing the data, with losing our recording. Mm-hmm. So let's do some pretending. Let's just say, as it turned out, it was nobody's fault. Nobody made any mistakes that we can trace back and say somebody clicked something wrong or whatever. Well, no, I mean it's a malfunction of the computer.
Yeah, it could have.
Remember? Well, no, it really was. It was it was a computer glitchy kind of thing.
Yeah, and it
right?
got you a Mac.
So this was because of that, I ended up getting a Mac. I know, I love it. But this is a case where there literally was no one to blame. The universe. It's just like if it rains on your picnic, you know, there's no one to blame, right? But what if it had been my fault? What if I had clicked a button and caused it to happen? Now, I'm just going to go through a list of the possible things that could have been to blame. Maybe I had made a mistake, and it could have been a mistake because of ignorance, or it could have been a mistake out of laziness, or just stupidity, or distraction. There's all these different things you can blame. If I had made the mistake, then you could blame me for having made the mistake. Or let's say you had made the mistake, the technical mistake.
Which would have been far worse.
Worse for you because you blame yourself harder than you blame others.
Right.
It's all the same crap. Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's say it had been malicious. Let's say it had, you know, we're just making this up, but let's say somebody had hacked in, knew we were recording that day or whatever. We're using this as an example for any time somebody does something intentionally to you to hurt you. So let's say somebody had intentionally sabotaged the computer just to throw us behind a whole day in recording and knowing we would stress like crazy over it. Now we have, now there's justice involved. We've been done wrong. We can not only blame that guy for the act of losing the material, but now we can heap all kinds of other negative energy out of us onto him because he's a criminal, he's a bad guy, and boy, blame, blame, blame. It just never ends. It never ends. That's why it's so important to learn how to end this, because this is the continual shit that is in our mind. Literally, however many years you live, you will be suffering from the blame game endlessly. Every time it comes up, either blame yourself, blaming somebody else, until you make a conscious effort to really work on it and say, you know what? I'm not going to blame. I'm not going to blame myself. Saying it isn't enough to do it. You have to do the work that we talked about in episode 3. But focusing on blame as one of the main areas to practice controlling your mind, observing your mind, is awesome. And I'm telling you, the first time you know you're innocent and somebody comes up and accuses you of something, and you don't have to say they're right. You don't have to say anything. That's the whole thing. You just like that monk. Okay. Okay. Anyone know the rest of the story?
What's that?
It's mind-boggling. He raised the child.
Wow. They threw the doom switch on me last night.
Unlucky you.
Yeah, for sure. Of course, there is no such thing as a doom switch. And
just seems like it.
Internet poker's not rigged. But internet poker has an entire range, an entire subset of tilt.
Oh, yeah. It tilt definitely issues. Has its own brands.
And yeah. Let's talk about some of those.
Okay. And what we can do about them.
And what we can do about them. Well, what you can do about them. I don't know if there's anything that I can do.
Well, what about, lost connection, for example. There's something that only happens on the internet.
Yes.
That can be a real tilt inducer.
Yes.
Right?
And it's actually there's two parts of it. One of them is when you lose it. And
right.
The other is when somebody else does and they give them a minute and a half.
Yeah.
They give them a minute and a half to come back.
Right.
And if you're in the hand, you're waiting for it, to come back on.
I look at this as the whole thing about lost connections is it's the game you're playing. It's like to get really upset about it is like getting upset because you're playing baseball but you don't like the size of the ball or something. You know, it's like this is the landscape you live in. It's computers. There's internet connections. Sometimes they break down. Sometimes it's going to be you. Sometimes it's going to be them. Sometimes guys are going to try to do it intentionally as an angle. That's just the world you play in. So knowing that and realizing that, it should be so that when a lost connection comes up, you're just like, okay, I lost a connection, and just breathe your way through it. You know, got pretty much one answer for everything.
Yeah, and then there's computer wait time.
Now, computer wait time, this is a one that I use all the time. You know, it doesn't matter whether I'm playing poker or whatever. Computers take some time sometimes, mm-hmm. right? So here's the situation. You're sitting at your desk, and there's something going on your computer that's going to take 3 seconds, 5 seconds, a minute, a download, whatever. It doesn't matter. This is a recurring thing in our lives. I now see this, every one of them, as a great, great opportunity to practice. So instead of being anxious and thinking like, oh, damn, I wish this thing would speed up, this is what they mean by transforming suffering. You literally transform your suffering into non-suffering or into joy. So instead of being sitting there anxious, waiting for a minute, I sit up straight. I use that break as an opportunity to just calm myself, to settle my waves, to tune my instrument. Every single little computer delay you have, whether you're playing poker or not, is an opportunity to tune your instrument.
Okay, what are some of the things that we can do?
Well, one thing we can do is just write on a piece of paper the reminders you want to have of that day. If there's something you've moved to the object of the game, put on a piece of paper, have it there sitting in front of you. Another thing I think is really great for keeping your tilt down online is just staying busy, just staying really active on all the things you're doing, game selecting, you know, whatever it is you've got going on related to the game, just stay busy. And then that keeps the tilt out. Taking breaks, obviously, we've covered that a lot before, but that's huge. Taking a lot of breaks, taking really good mindful breaks, remove yourself from the game. That's one of the biggest, biggest tilt reducer things you can possibly do. Taking days off, even. We talked about
big breaks.
Yeah, big breaks. Exactly. We talked about in terms of like stop losses. You know, typically those are thought of in terms of a session. But you can do stop losses in terms of weeks. You know, and you can say, well, let's say you have two real bad days. And you decide, if I lose today again, I'm taking 3 days off. And take big breaks, like you said, really big breaks.
When they threw the doom switch on me, I lost five out of six sit and goes. And I said, it's not
break
my
time.
Day.
Yeah.
I'm done.
Yeah, right. Just it's great to just quit when you're stuck and everything's running bad. That's major lopping off the C game. And one thing I've run into is I used to think that the big problem everybody had was they didn't quit soon enough and that they played too much. That was because that's how I was and how all my degenerate buddies were. But it turns out in the modern age of the modern young professional, some guys, they just don't play enough. I have a lot of clients that are like, I need you to teach me how to play more. They only play 2 or 3 hours a day. They want to play 4 or 5. They only play 4 days a week. They want to play 5. And so what I do with them is it's kind of like the opposite of quitting drills that we talked about, where you just obsessively quit really short sessions, is playing drills, where you just force yourself to play, even if it's just for 10 minutes, to get over that hump of I don't sit down often enough and play. Because one of the things that's the hurdle, it's like, oh, I don't want to play for an hour or two, so you don't play at all. Well, you just decide, I'm going to play for 10 minutes. This is where you've changed the object of the game. You're not doing it to make money. You're just training yourself to sit in a chair and play. I call that a playing drill. So that's it. That's not so much a tilt-related thing, but it's one of those things we can use online for people that have trouble getting enough hours in.
And, of course, sit up, breathe.
Sit up and breathe is pretty much my answer to everything.
And finally, finger tilt.
Finger tilt. Finger tilt is when your fingers somehow have a mind of their own, and they just do what they're going to do. It's just crazy, but it's the nature of computers. It's so fast. You know, table poker, you've always got some time in there between the act of deciding what you're going to do and the money getting in the pot. Where online, it's just like so instantaneous. So, you know, my one suggestion for this is when the big pot comes up and the turn's coming, you know, and the big action's happening, train yourself to just literally take your hand and put it in your lap if you have trouble with what I'm calling finger tilt. And that is, so you make your bet, and instead of keeping your hand on the mouse, you just put it in your lap. And all you're doing is you're giving yourself a chance to create just a little bit of space in your physical mechanics, which might give a little bit of space in your mind, just enough so that the instantaneous horrendous action doesn't happen.
And finally, a subject that is near and dear to my heart, as you well know, and that applies not only to internet poker, but also to live poker or table poker, is running bad. I run bad.
Well, you think you run bad, and that's the whole point, right? Running bad is just an idea. It's just a thought. It's a case of us living in the past. For example, when you lost that fifth sit-and-go mm-hmm. to a bad beat, mm-hmm. okay, at that split second, there was no running bad. At that moment, at the moment that you lost that hand, we're talking about focusing everything in on the moment. At that moment, there was no streak. There was no past. There is no future. It's only that moment. So one of the ways to overcome this huge burden we carry around with us, that, you know, the idea of running bad, is literally letting go of the past, which are ideas in our mind, and it's just thoughts. And here again, I can say these ideas a zillion times, but until someone actually does the practices that we talked about in episode 3 of mindfulness practice of, you know, training your mind to come back to the moment, It doesn't matter. I could say that a billion times. It wouldn't help you at all. You have to do the work to train your mind to learn how to come back to the moment. And then running bad during those moments, during those specific moments when you've come back to the present, at that moment, there'll be no running bad. It's kind of like we talked about before. If you took a frying pan, smashed yourself in the head with it right when you lost that fifth tournament, you would not have been running bad at that moment, right?
I would have been suffering.
Yeah. You would have been suffering a different kind of suffering, but you wouldn't have been suffering the pain of having lost those events. That's because at that moment you would have been completely present tense. So it's the act of coming back to the present tense is the cure for running back. Wayne, there was one other thing about running bad I wanted to get in here. Pretty important.
Okay.
When you manage to get from where the act of losing doesn't hurt in a situation where it used to, and I don't mean where you're never going to suffer from losing again, but let's say a certain situation comes up that you know in the past would have caused you a great deal of suffering, and because you've been working on these things and doing the practice, at this particular instance, it doesn't cause you suffering, that in itself, that awareness that, wow, this used to hurt, and today it doesn't, that in itself is like a higher level joy that is just wonderful. So you doubly gain. You gain from not suffering when you would have, but then you gain extra happiness from realizing that, wow, I really have let go of a lot of this suffering, and it gives you a great outlook for the future because you're like, wow, it doesn't have to be as bad as it has been.
Or as Death Donkey says, bad beats suck out your soul, and so it won't hurt when they take the last piece of my soul. Live poker, mm-hmm. Everything can tilt you.
There's a lot, yeah.
Last night had a dealer that wouldn't shut up, that thought they were going to get a lot more tips if they just kept talking and being friendly and slowing down the game.
Sit up. Breathe.
And there was a drunk who was just being totally obnoxious to everybody.
Rise above it.
And the guy to my left was a really nice guy, but he just wouldn't let me concentrate.
Let it go.
Okay. And then finally, I lost a huge pot.
Sit up. Breathe.
There's not anything else left to say, is there?
Yeah, I can say that a few hundred more times.
Let it go. What about watching movies as a pain reliever?
Watching movies is a great pain reliever. I mean, I used to do it all the time, and I didn't even know how it worked. And when I figured out how it worked, it was really, really amazing, because if you think about it, when you're watching a movie, where is your mind?
In the movie. Well, right. Depends on the kind of movie.
But what are your senses tuned into? What are your eyes and your ears doing at that moment?
It's on the screen.
It's on the screen, which is in the present tense.
Right.
So at that moment, you're not thinking about the bad beats. You're not worried about the what's coming up, right?
Right.
So movies serve as suffering remedy because they force the mind to be in the present tense. Isn't that amazing? So you can think of this whole thing as proof, in a sense, as validation for the idea that coming back to the moment is the act of pain relief by not being in the past and the future. And that's why... especially poker players, you know, a lot of guys I know watch a lot of movies because it's like, oh, man, I got to stop the pain somehow. And without even thinking about it, they do whatever it takes to sort of numb the thinking. And it's always about coming back to the present tense. Now, what we're talking about with mindfulness practice and concentration and all that is doing it without the movie. You know, John Kabat-Zinn says, you know, watching a movie or even taking drugs or whatever, you're going below the thinking. You're ending the thinking, but you're going below it. When you do it just by raw awareness, by just sheer awareness of living in the moment, unfiltered, uncovered by anything, then you're rising above the thinking. It's the more pure, better way to do it. So by all means, watch movies to relieve the pain, but there's another way it can be done without the movie.
That's really cool.
It is.
I think too much. I can't stop thinking. I'm thinking all the time. From the moment I wake up to the moment I go to bed, I am thinking.
It's never stopped.
Never stops.
You know what your problem is?
No.
You're a human being. Like everyone. Everyone has the same problem. I have people come up to me, they're like, oh, or my mind just races all the time. I can't get to stop. And my mind's way busier than anybody else's mind. It's like, no, it's not. We're all the same. We're all the same, or in the same way we have arms and legs, we all have the racing mind. I like the word discursive. They call it discursive thought. For me, that word just captures it perfectly. It's like out of control, and it just goes, churns, it never ends.
Are you sure discursive doesn't mean bad handwriting?
Okay, wait, I'm going to paint a little picture for you here. Imagine you are overweight, but you don't even know it.
Have you seen my ass? I can't see it, but I know it's there.
So you have this problem, but you don't even know about it. And you're carrying stuff around with you, extra body matter, that if you didn't have it, you would feel better. right? So then you learn about calories, and you learn that if you were smaller, you would feel better. So now that you know the cause of why you don't feel as good as you could, and you know what you could do to fix it. That if you ate fewer calories than you burned, you would lose weight. And this cause and effect is absolute. If there was any doubt, like if you still had doubts about it, that whether or not this was true about losing weight, all you'd have to do is eat less for a while to find out. Meditation is the same way. It's exactly the same way. If you meditate, you will suffer less, just in the same way that if you eat fewer calories than you burn, you will lose weight. And it can be easily tested. All you have to do is do it. It takes daily effort and discipline. It requires new habits. That's really what we're talking about here. And the benefit is a reduction in unhappiness that will permeate every aspect of your life.
It's funny you say this, because just 2 days ago, yesterday, we ran into Alex. And Alex was telling me about this and how he started doing it. And he had to do it every single day for 3 weeks. And he felt so different. It was an amazing story. It was cool coming from Alex.
Yeah, he basically told you his whole path. And
see, I won't believe it with you, but I'll believe it with Alex. I don't know why that is.
Because you said you see yourself in him, remember?
Scary.
No, but remember what he said? He goes, you know, after 3 weeks, I stopped arguing with my wife. I mean, these changes are so profound. It's truly mind-boggling.
And I understand the... you know, the practice of every single day. There was a famous violinist who said that if I don't practice for 1 day, I know it. If I don't practice for 2 days, my wife knows it. And if I don't practice for 3 days, everybody knows it.
Oh, that's good. I like it. I have a web page at my site that I've made. It's intended for people just getting started. And it's got all kinds of information in there. It's books I've read, various writings by me and other people, some links to some websites that I think are really good. And it's a page that's going to keep growing with whatever sort of things I feel like putting on there. The address is tommyangelo.com/meditation101.html. There's also a fair amount about yoga on there, which is what I want to go into here. Now, I would like to remind anyone that episode 3 of the series called Mindfulness, we go into great detail about meditation, but you really need to go to that web page or similar web pages to get the real how-tos if you really want to do what's called formal sitting meditation every morning. Yoga, according to Jon Kabat-Zinn, one of the chapters of his book, he just says, yoga is meditation. You know, we think of yoga as being a physical exercise because of all the stretching. But I came up with a little analogy that I think really shines a light well on the relationship of some of the key components of yoga. And here it is. In music, you have two components. You have rhythm, and then you have notes. So if I just sit here and tap, that's recognizable as music because it has a repetitive pattern and it just feels like music. It's like, you know, I know what music when I hear it. But if I just make random notes, if I just say, dong, bum, bum, ba-dum, bum, just all over the place, no rhyme or reason, that's just sound. It's not music, but it's notes, okay? So with music, you got two things, rhythm and notes. But the one essential ingredient is the rhythm. You can have music with rhythm and no notes, but you can't have music with notes and no rhythm, all right? Here's how that relates to yoga. In yoga, you have two major pieces. There's the stretching and there's the breathing. So the analogy goes like this. breathing is to rhythm as stretching is to notes. In other words, if you do the stretching without the breathing, that's like doing the notes without the rhythm. It's just stretching. It's just sound. It's just noise. It's the equivalent of bum, bum, bum. It's all over. But if you do the breathing without the stretching, that's yoga. In other words, some of the poses of yoga are static. You don't move. You don't even stretch. Mountain pose, you just stand perfectly still with your back straight and breathe. It's the breathing that makes it yoga. Corpse pose, which is how you would typically end a session. You lie flat on your back with your hands, palms up, the arms out, and you breathe. You're not even moving, but it is absolutely yoga. So the breathing is the essential act of yoga. Well, if you've been paying attention, you've noticed that the breathing is the essential act of sitting meditation and all mindfulness practice. That's what makes yoga meditation, is the breathing.
Last night I was playing online.
Stop right there.
What?
I know what you're doing.
What?
You're just going to tell a bad beat story.
Yeah.
Well, it's a bad habit, and we're going to stop all your bad habits right now.
Okay. Good luck.
So let's talk about bad beat stories as an example of something I call band-aids and cures. For all of these bad habits, you pick a bad habit, you have it poker. And I think a really good way of looking at it is, there's band-aids, there's things you can do to try to fix it right now and put a patch on it, and then there's cures, which is the long-range fixes. And for me with bad beat stories, I did go through this path. It was like I hated myself for telling them, but I couldn't help it. And I would, over the years, I would tell bad beat stories, and a little bit fewer, and I hated myself for doing it. And so that's the band-aid. The band-aid is just to power up, like, You're picking up the phone, like pretend you're about to dial and you're just like shaking and you have to stop. I'm not going to do it. That would be like a band-aid.
Duct tape on my mouth.
Duct tape on your mouth?
That would work, yeah.
So as to the cure, well, we already know what that is, right?
Stop playing poker?
Well, that would be one.
Okay.
But there's life bad beat stories too. The cure for stopping the telling of bad beat stories is to not have those thoughts in your mind. This is why taming the mind, controlling the mind, is such a great practice. Because the telling of a bad beat story is simply thoughts gushing out your mouth. And if the thoughts aren't in your mind, literally aren't in your mind, then the story won't come out of your mouth. And that's the cure. It's always coming back to taming the mind and managing what's in there. And then there's compassion. We normally think of compassion as feeling sorry for someone, pity. It's hard to describe it without using those words or almost using them. And, you know, it's like you walk by a bum on the street and you feel some sort of like, at least that's not me, or, you know, some kind of feelings like that. I used to get very uncomfortable when I would walk by a homeless person with their hand out. It just made me so uncomfortable because I didn't want to look at them. I would feel bad about it. I knew I wasn't going to give them anything. And just great discomfort. And whatever I felt, you know, there are times we just really want to help somebody, or I would call that, you know, that's like the non-Buddhist version of compassion. For example, we wouldn't be expected to feel compassionate toward somebody who is, you know, rich and beautiful. And when they do something kind of screwy, we're like, wow, look at that fuck up. Our compassion seems to be tied with someone's circumstances directly, whether they've had really bad luck or somebody died or whatever. You know, they need some and deserve some compassion. Or we look at their ability to support themselves situation. Let's say somebody's old and feeble and don't know what they're going to do, or just people we see all the time that are in dire straits. And so it's like we make a judgment about, you know, what's worthy of compassion, what isn't. And then if, you know, the situation qualifies, we're like, okay, well, I guess we should feel compassion. And, you know, I used to feel guilty for not feeling it when I thought I should. You know, I hear about an earthquake and 1,000 people died across the globe, and I'm like, you know, yeah, darn. But I really didn't feel any compassion. But then I would feel weird about not feeling it. So the Buddhist brand of compassion works like this. Everyone suffers, and everyone suffers for the same reasons and in the same way. And one of the effects of suffering is violence of every type. There's physical violence, there's spoken violence, it's, you know, harshness, meanness, cruelty. The list goes on of the ways we have of inflicting wounds on each other. And so, you know, because we just can't help but just judge everything, you know, sort of by standards, you know, cultural standards and what we feel and all that, you know, we look at some people and we're like, let's just say Dick Cheney, a guy a lot of people don't like, okay? And that image of him in the mind creates negative feelings, let's say, immediately. If he's not a good example, you know, just think of one. Think of one, someone you know that you really don't respect. And you don't like the way they behave, you don't like the way they treat their spouse or whatever. In the Buddhist version of compassion, you see the violence. We're just going to use that word with a very wide girth. And we judge it and we say that's wrong. And then, you know, I mean, there's no way we're going to feel compassion for the person committing the violence. But in the Buddhist brand, that's all you do. That's immediately where your attention goes. It's just a spike in human suffering, but that's all it is, and it is worthy of compassion, and it requires compassion. This means that, you know, the more violent and fucked up somebody is, the more in need and worthy of compassion they are. So it's dramatically different definitions of that word.
So in the course of us making this series over the last year or so, you've had a tremendous amount of exposure to all these grand ideas, these grand concepts of how we can make our life better, make ourselves happier, you know, by way of meditation and mindfulness practice. I just have one question for you.
All right.
Why haven't you started doing it?
Well, actually, it's more than one reason. It doesn't sound, yeah. I've got a good reason, and then I've got a really bad reason.
Okay.
The good reason is because during the making of this, in order for this to be authentic, we needed to have one person who does this and one person who doesn't do this. And, of course, that would be me.
The crash test dummy.
I'm the crash test dummy. Very good. And so I always thought that if I was ever, if I started practicing, if I started meditating, if I started, you know, really getting into it, it would hurt my character. It would, you know, not be authentic anymore. It wouldn't be real.
Right. You'd just be too happy all of a sudden to...
Yeah, right. And, you know, that leads me to the other thing of that it's very difficult for me. I'm not a joiner. I'm basically follow the Groucho Marx theory that I don't want to belong to anything that would have me as a member. And I resist any temptation to go along with everybody else. Mm. And I don't go into, you know, I don't like religion. I don't like groups. I don't like anybody who is a believer scares me.
Right.
I am perfectly 100% a doubting person. Mm-hmm. And I know that by contrast, I'm also the kind of person that does things 100%. I go straight headlong right into the brick wall. So I know that when I start this, I'm going to be very dedicated to it from the get-go.
Right.
So that's two reasons.
So you're
kind of
waiting for the series to end, in a sense, and is one of your reasons.
That's one of them.
And the other reasons, you might even think of them more like classic resistance things.
Absolutely.
You don't want to join, or it sounds like it's too preachy and, you know, too much like a religion, or you know, some people say they just can't. They're like, oh, well, I tried, but I couldn't calm my mind down. But you haven't even got to that point.
No.
Yet. You haven't even got to that excuse yet.
No, yeah. No. I've been waiting for this to be over, and it goddamn well it better be over pretty damn soon.
Well, you know, just to clarify something, have I ever pushed you even one time to say, you know what, you should start doing this?
Honestly?
Yeah.
Every moment of every day, of every second that we have ever been together, and almost all of the time that we're not. Because if there's any person in the world that I want to emulate, it would be you.
Well, that wasn't quite the answer I was looking for. But in terms of words, no, I hear what you're saying. I appreciate that. But in terms of words and actions, but I've never said the words to you, look, you should do this, right?
Bro, actions speak louder than words. Your actions. And I'm not saying that for anybody out there or for the series or even for you. It's you wanted me to answer honestly, and yes, I am motivated every single day. That's not being pushed, but it is being motivated.
So are you telling me you're going to start? Do you think you're going to start meditating now? Is that your plan?
Well, let's put it this way. In the last segment, you talked about ignorance. I use the traditional meaning of ignorance, meaning when you don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I now know what it takes to lose weight. Okay?
Yeah.
The difference between ignorance and stupidity is ignorance is when you don't know. Stupidity is when you refuse to act on the knowledge
when
that
you do
receive.
Know. Yeah.
Exactly right. I'd like to think of myself as not a stupid man, despite what everybody's going to think after 7 hours of, you know, of my lunacy. I'd like to think myself not a stupid man. I'm no longer ignorant. I don't want to be stupid. I have every intention of starting to practice, of meditating, of doing yoga, of trying to eat better and improve my life and just become the best person I can possibly be. There's no doubt in my mind that I'm going to give it every effort that I possibly can, because how can I not? And if in a year we come back and we do an hour on Deuces Cracked about, you know, where we are a year from now, and I'm still practicing and, you know, life is better and everything, then...
Yeah, we can sit around and make a recording of us counting all the money you've made to poker from being such a tiltless machine for a year.
That would be sweet.